Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Good afternoon, PageCast listeners. This is Mputum Indabeni once again. At the invite of Jonathan Ball Publishers, we are broadcasting from Cape Town. We have a wonderful guest from across the Atlantic. Her name is Professor Brouwen Everell. She is the author of Not Made by Slaves and Abolition and the Empire in Sierra Leone and Liberia. She is a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and was the director of the Center of African Studies at the University of Cambridge. She now teaches at Princeton. Yes, one of the universities that stood up to Trump's silly demands, and is a research affiliate at the Laboratory of the Economics of South Africa, South Africa's past at Stellenbosch University. Welcome to Cape Town, Professor Everell.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Are you enjoying our weather?
Loving it, yeah. It's a little bit rainy at the weekend, but now it's nice and sunny and warm.
Oh, I forgot about that, brother. It was a little bit rainy here. I've been up north. It was very hot. Welcome again to South Africa. This is a wonderful book you have written. And the first thing I must say is the tone that I like, because it's written with a tone of empathy and not a condescending attitude towards Africa. And those things, I had to mention it because it is very rare. Tell me, first of all, and I know sometimes as a writer I get irritated when people ask me this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What made you decide to write this book?
Yeah. So I think this is a book that has been sort of in long gestation in the back of my mind. I think I first started thinking about the problems that I talk about in the book in the early stages of my PhD research back in 2007, 2008. I think arriving to do research in Sierra Leone and Liberia on, you know, their 19th century history, not at all on contemporary affairs, and being confronted by the sort of overwhelming presence of, you know, humanitarian aid and development experts in the period right after their civil wars, I was surprised to see so many parallels with the kinds of things that the people I was studying in the 19th century were interested in. So people proposing that focusing on agriculture was going to fix Africa, or focusing on trade was going to fix Africa, or focusing on changing this aspect or that aspect of the, you know, what they were seeing on the ground in the 19th century read very cleanly onto what I was seeing around me as I was, you know, in Freetown and in Monrovia for that research. So it wasn't something that I was researching at the time, and it wasn't really the point of what I was researching. But I, you know, I observed it, and I was asked a few questions about it at the time, and I had started to think about it. And then as I've been working as a historian of mostly West Africa, you know, teaching the history at universities in the UK, I, you know, kept coming across the fact that students really had very little sense of the kinds of economic interventions that had gone before. So lots of people take African history as undergrads because they're really interested in helping the continent, in going on to do a degree in development studies or, you know, in African studies even. But don't necessarily see how their own desire to intervene fits into a longer trajectory and a longer engagement with the continent. Mm-hmm. And so over that period, I kept finding myself telling a story very similar to this over and over again to these students. And so I thought, you know, actually, I should put this down on paper so that it gets beyond, you know, the limited number of students that I can teach in a given year. You know, I think we know very well the story of colonial exploitation.
Yes.
Of the continent. I think much less well understood is the role that that kind of well-meaning intervention played in that imperial story.
Yes. Well, since you have already touched on that, for the benefit of our listeners, let me tell you that especially the first parts of the book have got quite kind of a comparative study between Sierra Leone and Liberia and how they approached the national development. And you tell us where one fails, where one succeeds better. But I'm going to be further presumptuous and make a summary of the thesis of your argument. Please feel free to expand on it and to correct me, because I'm going to probably make some mistakes. But I did spend a whole lot of last night thinking about it, because that is how I approach a book when I've finished it. And I try to tell myself, what is this book saying? You understand? Especially a book that is a non-fictional book. So how I thought about it was that the Afroconomics, which is the title of the book, the subtitle is, subheading is a history of Western ignorance. So you already know where this book is going, which I love anyway. It's kind of, when I think about it, it's an economic thought. It says, it's thesis actually, that economic thought and behavior are culturally informed. And I had, and this actually is a quote, I can't remember, it's a quote from your book, but I can't remember where I went. And I wanted to quote the page, but I couldn't remember where I got it. But I just love that sentence, that economic thought and behavior are culturally informed. So this to me tells me that therefore, to be understood properly, anyone who has not grown up or learned that culture has no business in telling people living that culture how they should be doing it. So in a way, I'm telling myself, this book is trying to caution us away from what I will call economic imperialism, especially when it comes to Africa. So that we must first move away from that know-it-all attitude that most even philanthropists come to Africa with that idea that we're coming here to help these people, and then they must listen to us because we know better than them. You know how it goes in your country. I can't remember who said this, but it's economic, stupid. So everything is interpreted and explained as economics. But I love this book because this book is telling us that even economic laws are not necessarily universal, and they are not scientific as other people think. And so you cannot say they are not timeless. So every culture has a way of looking at it, and every culture has a way of developing it. So as much as it's okay to work with people, but don't look down on them. Did I try?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Please expand for our readers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has always been a sort of puzzle in thinking about that idea of imperialism, and in thinking about what it means when people talk about neocolonialism or those kinds of questions, is, you know, okay, so there's exploitation, and we understand the role that plays, and there's, you know, financial exploitation, and there's debt, and all of those kinds of elements of it. But what is it, you know, like lots of trade relationships are unequal. Lots of business partnerships have some sort of unequal power to them. So what is it that really sets the way that people are approaching Africa apart from that, and what gives it that neo-imperial edge? And I think what it is that condescension, right? Mm-hmm. Is that sort of what I call, I think in the book, the power of pity, right? This idea that by getting involved in all, you're doing somebody a favor, right? And so what I think ends up happening is that excuses a lot of bad behavior, because people think that, well, it's all for the greater good, right? So, you know, oh, well, we're going to do this thing and it will have these bad outcomes, but it's for civilization, or it's for development, or it's for, you know, and so
For their greater good. Right. They must come to our level.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it takes the power away, you know, it takes away that power to say, actually, no, we don't want this because essentially the power of pity is to be like, no, but you have to want it because we have something that you want. You know, you want to be like us,
yeah,
right?
But where I love it most is you say that this attitude was set in motion by the good intentions of the anti-slavery movement.
Yeah.
Can you please tell our readers about it? Because that's the part actually I found most fascinating.
Yeah, the wildly controversial
yes.
claim. Yeah. Well, I think because there had been this longstanding trading relationship, which was based on the slave trade, which obviously is, you know, pure exploitation. When the people who started to oppose the slave trade arrived, particularly in West Africa, but also elsewhere in the continent in the late 18th century, you know, they came thinking that whatever was here already, whatever trade relationships had been established, whatever this power relationship was, must be awful because it was contributing to the slave trade. So immediately they come in wanting to destabilize those existing relationships, wanting to destabilize those trading norms, wanting to exert, you know, new kinds of moral pressure to say, abandon the slave trade. And so one of the really important things that they miss is that there are plenty of people who are not participating in the slave trade already on the continent. There are plenty of people who objected to the slave trade. There are plenty of people who, you know, moved away from the coast so that they wouldn't have to participate in it. But a like really core foundational idea amongst the early anti-slavery campaigners was that they were necessary to come to the continent to teach people that slavery was wrong. And that wasn't something, you know, that people had figured out on their own. Plenty of people had figured that out on their own. Yes, of course, there were places that were, you know, materially benefiting from the slave trade, right? There were plenty of, you know, you got the Kingdom of Dahomey, for instance, that really does benefit. And in fact, uses a lot of the, you know, the income from the slave trade to build a big, you know, powerful state, right? Yeah. And distribute wealth to its followers and everything, you know, all the things that you think of as also being the case, for instance, in Britain, right? Where the slave trade benefits the development of society. So, yeah, so it's that initial moral impulse that sort of galvanizes what I see as then a sort of cycle of interventions cascading on from there that somehow, you know, British and then whoever happens to have the hegemonic power at any given time, that it's their role to teach Africans to, you know, do the economy in a morally coherent way.
To be able to be self-sustained as if they did not know how to do that. But what I love most also, again, you can hear that I use a word of love almost always, which means I really like this book. It's how you showcase, which is actually is a rare thing, that Black people themselves were not helpless in fighting slavery. And then you talk about this first guy who went to the Vatican to put a case. I think they called it Kafunda. And then what fascinates me is that it was as far back as 1684, and I wrote his name is Lorenzo da Silva de Madoncia. And it's now a pope has just been elected. I'm Roman Catholic, by the way, so it's quite interesting that the first protest was taken to the Vatican, and they were protesting, actually accusing states that were practicing slavery, including the Vatican itself, that this is a crime against humanity. I was fascinated by that term because we think that term is modern.
Yeah.
And then that term is as far back as that. So I love also how you don't make Black people as if they were helpless, waiting for a savior to, like, do you want to talk about that a little because I know, I'm sorry to say this, but in the Anglo-Saxon archives. It's those things are not followed. I'm happy, lucky in a sense that I also read the church history. So I came across it through the church history, this kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's this this interesting, you know, assumption that that slavery is legal under certain circumstances, right? And this is also true of, you know, a variety of parts of the world. Slavery is legal under certain circumstances, and therefore it must be legal under all circumstances, right? And when people try to put up barriers and say, actually, no, we don't enslave people in that way, or, oh, no, we can't sell those people overseas, or, no, those are my citizens, I don't want you to take them, then because of the power differential, those people are deposed. And a new, more friendly governor is put into place, or a new, more friendly king is put into place. And so, yes, over time, you know, you get slave trading states that are very invested in the slave trade. But I think a big part of that is through the kinds of interventions by the slave trading companies coming from outside anyway, right? So they're the ones who are propping up these much more amenable kingdoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's plenty of reaction against the slave trade. And you see it most clearly in those early days when people are have some agency. But
And most fascinating is your developmental narrative on it. You use that failure of understanding, or should I say, the difference of worldviews, to showcase your thesis, because you say how Europeans understood labor is not how Africans understood labor, and which is the reason why there was a misinterpretation of even the concept of slave, because Africans put much more value on the human beings rather than, and then you continue to compare on the understanding of land also, which is a burning issue in this country.
Yes.
It's a very burning issue in this country that it was to the Africans kind of a blasphemy, even an idea that an individual will want to own land. So this is why when they came, these good to do philanthropists, and they were talking with Africans and wanting to be given land, and then the Africans become confused. But what do you mean about that?
Right.
You understand that there's this. Yeah. What was that later? Francis, the one, the first book you discuss.
Oh, in the very beginning, Anna Maria Falconbridge.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah. So
yes.
She doesn't really understand what's going on.
I could see that you wanted to showcase that how they were out of their depth, and it was a collision of worldviews.
Yeah, and so she's trying to explain what she's seeing to her readers back in England, and she assumes a lot of things. She thinks that what she's seeing is poverty, and she thinks it's sort of underdevelopment of the land, and she doesn't really recognize that, you know, in this particular place, wealth is calculated in people, because people are the scarce resource rather than land being the scarce resource, as it is back in Britain. And so one of the big interventions that they want to do is to privatize land ownership, right? So that they can, you know,
to the agriculture products.
Yeah. So they think that, like, you know, oh, they need agricultural productivity and all this stuff. They don't realize, you know, obviously that there's plenty of agriculture already and things are going fine. So there's a misunderstanding about where that where wealth lies in the two places. But I think one of the things that the book really tries to do is also to point out that these ideas are cultural back in Britain, or back in France, or back in the US, or wherever as well, right? So it's not so clear cut that, you know, well, in Africa, they have wealth and people, and in England, they have wealth and land. Because at the very same time that Anna Maria is writing this, right, you've got Jane Austen writing about something which was very similar to wealth and people back in England, right? And so actually, there's a meeting point. There is a place where they could...
They don't recognize,
but
they don't join the dots.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a sort of... You know, there's a sort of imagination of this detached thing, which is the economy, which is supposed to function in these particular kinds of ways. And those assumptions change over time as well. The book covers 250 years, like a lot of that changes in those periods. But that sort of continues to float above, when in reality, on the ground, the economy runs in a very different way back at home as well. And if there was a bit more self-reflection, a bit more understanding of the way that culture feeds into their understanding of the economy, then there would be a sort of place where they could, you know, meet and think about these things together.
Yeah. I love actually how you expose that as the ignorance, which I think is where the subtitle of the Western ignorance comes by, because it's just a refusal of seeing what is in front of you and joining the dots. But it's the same thing, just from the other angle and all that stuff. In any case, without laboring this point, I'm going to ask the last question. Why do you suppose the Global North refuses to acknowledge that even their economic and national wealth it has foundations on slavery and colonial extraction of raw materials from the Global South?
It's such a good question. I think like one of the things that I think the book is trying to get across is that I think there's a lot of self-delusion that really that the reason that the West or Global North is rich is because of knowledge and expertise rather than because it has a lot of money, rather than because a lot of that money comes from the same period and from a lot of the decisions that were made about extraction, right? And I think throughout the period, there is this careful balancing act of, you know, the exploitation is happening at the same time as these well-meaning interventions. And in a lot of cases, the well-meaning interventions, I mean, some of the people are explicitly framing their interventions as like trying to counter what the exploitative Europeans are doing, or, you know, that it is this sort of dichotomy or this perception of a dichotomy, right? There are bad Europeans and there are good Europeans, and it's okay because we're some of the good Europeans, so we're making up for the bad that people are doing. But I think that there is a, you know, there is the power that comes with the ability to be the person who doles out the money, right?
Yeah.
And so so even the people who are very aware, the people who are trying to do the restitution or are trying to make amends for the ways that their countries or their societies have become wealthy through colonialism and extraction, they're still, you know, it's hard to imagine letting go of the power that comes with being the person who then gets to hand it back out.
I think I love the term you use. It's from a lack of self-reflection, whether it's on a continental, national, or personal but level. But it's basically that. But I don't want us to pretend as if this book is about blaming the West only. No. It also does not absolve our African leaders also, because they are part of the problem here, because even where they had a chance, let me make another example you make, that where the West gets it right is that because poverty is about relationships, the West were able to integrate their global economy and make it big, which is where Africa is also failing. And because Africa is contesting or facing the global economy in silos instead of like integrating it and working it together into relationship. And of course, were we to do that, say we have a sub-Saharanian economic bloc, that will give us leverage also into dealing with global economics. So I like that you also mentioned that, but I'm sure you know where I'm going, because I could see that you are a fan of Thomas Sankara.
Well, I think I put Sankara in there because I think he is a great encapsulation of how these trends move and the way that intervention can be so self-defeating, right? Because, you know, you get Sankara in the 80s planting trees, advocating for women's rights and equality.
Promoting local development.
Promoting local development, doing all of these things. At the time, he was seen as a socialist because he was read in that register. He was seen as, you know, obstructing, you know, U.S. and French ideas for the region, etc. And so he had to go. Fast forward to now, and he was promoting all the things that are now currently in the SDGs, right?
Like everything he said.
And so I think it's, you know, it's this idea that, you know, at the time it's like, oh, we've got this crazy leader who's doing these crazy things, got to get rid of him, right? Got to intervene because he's going to tank Burkina Faso's economy because he's not following the path that we think is the path.
Yeah.
And then now we have a new path, which, oh, look at that. It happens to be exactly the same path that he was doing. Right? And so it's just, I think it's a good encapsulation of the ways that this kind of intervention ends up being so self-defeating and so, you know, it replicates itself generation after generation, because every generation is cleaning up the mess of the previous one.
And again, we know the story. Even Sankara himself was undone by the cooperation of imperialist West and local African leaders.
Exactly.
That wanted to get rid of him because they believe in that system of, you call it the gifts. with the Sankara, which is basically the system of patronage.
Right.
That they are given money by the West and then they should be grateful to the West and behave according to what the West wants and not associate themselves too much with communist China or communist Russia.
Right.
We know the story, Lumumba.
Yeah, exactly.
And then unfortunately, the story in Burkina Faso still continues. If you look at the current president, who himself models on Sankara, actually.
In a weird way.
In a weird way, he models himself on Sankara. But we've heard now that the French wants to get rid of him and the Russians want to defend him and China is in the mix.
Yeah.
And it's such a complex matter. Like, when do you think we will learn?
Yeah. Well, I think there's another example, I think, in that same chapter, which is looking at Zimbabwe's attempts to import arms from China.
Yes.
To put down a particular strike that was happening in Zimbabwe, which I think gives hope, right? So, you know, there was a lot of flurrying around as people were like, oh, should we impose embargo? Like, should the West get involved, etc.? The West didn't need to get involved because what ended up happening was that South African dock workers stood in solidarity with the Zimbabweans and the ships never landed and the guns never made it there. And so I think that's a great example of the ways that, you know, we can see things working from the ground up. We can see regional cooperation. We can see people working together to make sure that governments don't misbehave. And I think there is a lot of history, you know, which I try to get into in the book, of, you know, existing ideas of the moral economy, existing ideas about how to regulate leaders. There's, you know, lots of existing ground up ideas about how leadership should behave that doesn't need us to come in and say, did you guys know you have a bad leader?
No, I saw what you did there, that you are promulgating the idea that you've already said that people have agency. If only they could understand their power, especially when they come together.
Yes.
And in Africa now, there is, because people are kind of despondent on the idea of democracy, because democracy itself is very chaotic.
It is.
And it needs a knowledge, because one of the things that actually, if I must say to you, when I was still considering myself a student of philosophy, I took umbrage on is Plato's hate for democracy. But now, the more I grow, the more I see what is happening in South Africa, the more I see what is happening in even in the USA, and I think to myself, I wonder if Plato had an idea. And of course, his hatred for democracy is the fact that the demos can never be informed enough to be able to make intelligent decisions about their own lives, which is what exactly you are disputing.
I am disputing that.
The demos are intelligent enough to make their own decisions.
Yeah, I think Plato's an elitist.
Yes, I totally agree myself that he was an elitist, and I myself am a Democrat, so I am very, very pro your stance, which is why I love this book so much. Okay, lastly, you knew that I will have talk about this, the AGOA. And it speaks to your thesis again. For the sake of those who don't know, the AGOA is the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is the way that America helps African states to get into the market of the U.S. and all that stuff without so-called terrorists and whatever. But seemingly Trump has stopped that, and it has cost us in South Africa, especially on the supply of ARVs. But the beauty of it, voila, all of a sudden the government has found money to fill in that gap and buy ARVs itself. So in a way, Trump is a blessing. People are saying that, but
interesting.
For Africa to wean itself away from a core dependence on the West, would you agree with that?
I would say that there have been very long-standing arguments about the distortion effect that, like, you know, U.S. agencies like USAID have had. I think there are real tragedies in the loss of funding for, you know, PEPFAR and stuff. I think that it has happened at a moment which I'm optimistic about, I guess, or cautiously optimistic about. Mm. I think it's a crisis, but a crisis that comes at a time when countries like South Africa have already begun looking to other markets. You know, that the BRICS have been exerting themselves more as a force. You have the African free trade area emerging. There are lots of new and potentially hopeful avenues for thinking about trade and thinking about new kinds of cooperative mutual aid kind of ways of going about it. So I think, you know, I think it's too bad, but I think that that from the perspective of when it's happened, I don't think that it's like the worst possible timing.
Okay, Professor Evren, I have to ask this because yours was the first book I could see the link between slave trade, imperialism, and colonialism. Please, lastly, because we are running out of time, can you explain to me this, to our readers, this link? Because it's the first book I actually got it very in my thick skull. That okay, now I understand how these things are linked.
Yeah, I think because both the slave trade and imperialism are exploitative, it can be easy to draw the link directly. But I don't think actually the link was very direct. I think what actually happens is that there's the slave trade, which is very much sort of managed on the coasts in these little outposts, and which over which there is like a sort of negotiated agency. And then when the anti-slavery movement moves in, they're trying to impose, you know, new rules. And in order to impose new rules, they have to set up governance structures. And it's the gradual creep of those governance structures and the kinds of interventions that they're trying to make and the sort of plans that they're making for what the economy is going to look like afterwards that really moves into the kind of government that we recognize as colonialism. Mm. Then the connection back to exploitation is that once those governments are in place, they realize how hard it is to do the things that they want to do with the land labor ratio that they have on their hands, with the people who are not all that keen on being ruled, with the sort of economic plans that they have that don't really match up with the economic plans that people on the ground have. And so they impose rules regulating labor that look quite an awful lot like the slavery that they claimed that they were stopping.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Prof, for taking time to talk to us. My kind reader, this book tells us in bold and empathic manner how we should be thinking differently about African economics. And the book, which is available in all major bookstores in South Africa now, is called Afri-Economics by Browan Averim, A History of Western Ignorance. I love that subtitle. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful. Thank
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.